Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's a weekly show about health, nutrition, fitness, and all things lifestyle. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Graham Anthony. Today we're going to meet Julie Clam, author of New York Times bestsellers, including You Had Me at Woof and Love at First Bark. Now, what, you say you haven't heard of Julie Clam? Well, that's because for all her success as an author, she is not yet a celebrity. So we're going to discuss her new book titled The Stars in Our Eyes, The Famous, The Infamous, and Why We Care Way Too Much About Them. We'll discuss her fascination and pop culture's obsession with fame and celebrity and why it matters. Or does it?
That's right. Or does it? I can't wait to explore that question. Our second guest is Dr. Lee Waters. She is the president of the International Positive Psychology Association. I bet you didn't know there was one of those. She's fascinating, this woman. She's written a book called The Strength Switch: How the New Science of Strength-Based Parenting Can Help Your Child and Your Teen to Flourish. She has a refreshing take on parenting with positivity. While we know how easy it is to focus on the negatives of what our children do, she turns the same situation around to help us help our children develop their inherent strengths.
Welcome to the midsummer edition of The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters.
This is Nanette Bush with Fairway Independent Mortgage, supporter and longtime listener of KPCW. Fairway Independent Mortgage offers personal home, vacation home, and investment property lending. Our mortgage team partners with local realtors to provide our clients with resources to understand the home finance process. Located at 1700 Park Avenue or at nanettebush.com.
Support of KPCW comes from Zions Bank Concierge-Style Executive Banking Services. Zions Bank. We haven't forgotten who keeps us in business. More information available online at zionsbank.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Graham Anthony. They are in our lives, like it or not, movie stars, TV stars, athletes, musicians, superstars of politics and business, talented, rich, beloved, reviled. And I have to say, some of them are criminals, because I've been thinking about the infamy of O.J. Simpson this week. Excuse me. Most importantly, they're famous. We live in a culture where fame and celebrity are revered, where the quote-unquote popular kids in high school seem to haunt us in adult life. What is it about these people and this culture? Our first guest, Julie Clam, has always been enamored of celebrity, and she shares her insights on why it is an important part of modern life. Julie joins us. Welcome to The Mountain Life, Julie Clam.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. I have to tell you that I looked at this, at the background on your book, and I thought, well, celebrity, yeah, we don't do that on The Mountain Life. We don't talk about celebrities, right? We're bigger than that. And
right,
the more
right.
I read about it, the more fascinated I was, because as you say, at the end of the day, we are all interested at some level in celebrity. So why?
Well, one of the things is that the things that we do to escape in our life, whether it's go to a ball game or watch a movie or listen to an album or a TV show, the people that star in those events are the celebrities. We associate with them with this thing that brings us happiness and takes us out of our everyday. And we like to see them beyond the dimension of the TV or the baseball field, you know, see them, you know, just like us with their, you know, kid in a grocery store or something like that. But there's also been scientific experiments. There was a neurobiologist at Duke University that did a study with rhesus monkeys. And he gave them all a very salty snack, and then he gave them a choice of either having their favorite drink, cherry juicy juice, or looking at pictures of the high-status or celebrity monkeys. And they all picked looking at the pictures of the high status monkeys instead of drinking the drink. And they had to be bribed to look at the B-list monkeys after that. So it does seem like we are hardwired for this sort of interest beyond just, you know, this kind of guilty pleasure of looking at People magazine.
Wow. It certainly does suggest we're hardwired. If monkeys are doing it, well, it just makes sense that we are too.
Right.
And you talk about the guilty pleasure. I mean, there are those of us who do only look at People magazine when we're standing in the supermarket mm-hmm. checkout line.
Right.
And sometimes we hope the line goes a little bit more slowly so that we can gaze at it. But never would we actually purchase
right.
one of
right.
those People magazines. What's the difference between the person who just looks at the headlines for the sake of, I don't know, rolling their eyes and those who uh-huh. purchase People magazine?
Well, I mean, I think there are some people that sort of relish the interest, the people that, you know, subscribe to magazines. And then, you know, I was on The Tonight Show last week and Jimmy Fallon said, you know, he looks down on celebrity worship. He sees his wife reading the magazines and says, ugh, why are you reading that garbage? And then he's like looking and saying, who got that? You know, it's like we can't help it. And I think that getting those little tidbits on the grocery line is sort of it's like a little taste, but it doesn't feel like it's like you're not getting drunk. You know, you're just having a spritzer. And you know, it's not something that generally intellectual people are raving about. But I have a lot of very smart friends who watch reality shows and all of these things that are sort of lowbrow, and they love it, and they love these scandals, I think it sort of goes across the board with people. And even if you're not you're not interested in the Kardashians, you know, you might be interested in Yo-Yo Ma or somebody in who does more of what you're interested in, and a person is just, you know, whoever is a celebrity to you is a celebrity. It doesn't have to be a movie star or, you know, a reality star.
Well, Julie, I thought that Jimmy Fallon, who stands as one of those few really big celebrities who we all feel like we could have a beer with and have a good time.
Yes.
And that's part of his job description. We welcome him into our homes every night, and that's what
right.
America loves about that particular role.
Right.
But I also think he was only half joking when he said he hadn't filled his gas tank by himself in 5 years.
Well, I haven't filled my gas tank either. I think it's that there are some people who just, you know, and truly he is a celebrity, but he does have a very, you know, nice lifestyle. But you know, he certainly was outside of it a long enough time to appreciate what it is on the inside, and he sort of looks at it at both ends, being the person who interviews them and interacts with them all the time, and then you know, having his own celebrity, which is, of course, huge.
Well, and I appreciate him giving you a little warm up before you came on KPCW.
I'm going to be on KCEW, and I have no experience. And he said, why don't you come on The Tonight Show, and we'll see if we can, you know, make you feel a little more comfortable.
Well,
I hope it worked.
You did very well, and we're glad to have you here.
Thank you.
And now, can we get to the dirt? You and Jennifer Aniston.
There's a chapter in my book about my sort of evolving relationship with Jennifer Aniston. I loved her on Friends. She was, you know, warm and self-deprecating, and I would see her interviewed and just liked her personality. And then I sort of got caught up, you know, in her, like, I would tend to be finding myself picking up those magazines more than other magazines. And when she and Brad Pitt got together, it was this sort of glamorous fairy tale thing. And then when they split up, I was distraught. And, I mean, I was, like, walking around, and I have, you know, a pretty full life. I have a family and dogs and a lot of work. And I was walking around thinking, what went wrong? What happened? What? They seemed so happy. And, you know, I actually went, I was in therapy. I didn't, the headline said something that, like, I went into therapy because that I've been in therapy way longer than that. But I went to my therapist and said, and she saw my face and she said, you look really upset. And I said, this sounds crazy, but I'm really upset about Brad and Jen breaking up. And she said, you have no idea how many clients of mine have come in and said that. So, you know, I wasn't the only one who was sort of broken up about the breakup.
That is so funny. And if we were friends, Julie, and I hope we are, I would give you relentless ribbing about that for the rest of our friendship.
The thing about it is, and it is, it's like, you know, there are times where I am like, stop it, just stop it. I get home from the gym, go, you know, walk my dogs, prepare things, you know, clean or whatever, sit down to work. Then I go to Facebook and I see Charlie Sheen is trending. And I could care less about Charlie Sheen, right, but I click on it because that's how I am. And before you know it, I have gone down this rabbit hole of going from Charlie Sheen to Denise Richards, his ex-wife, to her boyfriend, Richie Sambora, and then what happened to Heather Locklear? What's she up to? John Bon Jovi, is he still alive? And, you know, hours have gone by. I've gone down this rabbit hole, and I can't even, I have nothing to show for it except this, you know, I can tell people the next day why Charlie Sheen was trending on Facebook. but, you know, but the other thing is I do feel like, you know, with, for example, the Brad and Jen breakup and many of the divorces, you know, I went through a divorce, and I think that, you know, there's a lot of, you know, transference of us putting ourselves into these situations. And at that time, my relationship was starting to break up, and I think it was, you know, definitely put something into relief because I was looking and saying the pictures of them, it was impossible to see. In fact, the weekend that before they announced that they were splitting up, there were these pictures of them traveling on this like beautiful tropical vacation. They both look, you know, stunning and they are, you know, holding each other and kissing. And so it was, you know, it wasn't like, and also I thought they were supposed to likable. So I always sort of root for everyone's relationships, knowing that many relationships should break up and the people in them are the only ones that really know what's going on.
Well, I think, I mean, as you're talking about Brad and Jen, and for goodness sake, let's not dwell on them. But, you know, yeah. I think we think that celebrities have earned or they have achieved somehow a higher standard of life in general, you know, whether it's their enjoyment of their tropical vacation or the things that they can afford. And so when they fall from grace, we're fascinated by it because, gosh, you know, we fall from grace, and it's not a very long fall, right? But
yeah,
for them,
well,
it isn't. So maybe it just makes us feel better about ourselves.
Yeah, there's definitely a little schadenfreude when, you know, you are looking at somebody who seems to have everything, and you see that they are missing something. You know, their relationship broke up, or they, you know, are in rehab or whatever, and you think, oh, well, actually, I am doing better than they are, you know, despite the great difference. And I also think that that there's, you know, because these people are, you know, in dramatic roles in their work, we sort of continue that script outside, and they are, you know, we make them be dramatic in their off-camera life. And, you know, so many times, at those grocery store magazines, you see somebody on the cover and it says, like, the other Jennifer Garner breaks down about Ben Affleck. And you look at the picture and you're like, she could be sneezing too. You know, they catch this, you know, strange expression, and, you know, and decide that that's what it is. But and everybody says, "Oh my God," you know, and you know, it's living under that kind of microscope is, you know, is not something I would ever want. It, you know, fortunately, it doesn't seem to be a problem. But you know, we've all had days where you know your kid has a temper tantrum and you have to like pick them up and grab them and jump in a cab or whatever. And people aren't photographing you doing it and talking about you being, you know, an abusive parent or, you know, giving your kid an ice cream before dinner, you know, or whatever the thing is. And you know, Katie Holmes and her daughter have been many times photographed in situations where they say what's going on. And I think no one knows and no one knows how hard it is. And every day is different. And really, you don't want to be looked at like that.
These are, particularly the stars of television and movies, are the friends that the rest of us all share and love to talk about, right? I mean, they exist mm-hmm. in my life the same they do as in Lynn's or in yours.
Mm-hmm.
They're
right.
They're at arm's length, and we get mm-hmm. to think what we want and have an opinion.
Right.
And no one judges us for that opinion.
That's right. And if you're talking about them behind their backs, they're not going to find out, and you can do it very comfortably. You know, it's amazing how many people have opinions on these strangers' relationships or their parenting or their, you know, how they do business or party or dress. You know, I can't even imagine if people saw what I wore, you know, to go into Starbucks or wherever, and they're, you know, they're being talked about and judged all the time, and some of them you can see it really gets to them, and some of them, you know, they're sort of just ride over it.
So, are these is there a threshold that, in your experience, you've sort of decided above which you become a celebrity? Because there are thousands of actors who we see frequently, mm-hmm. but who never arrive to that place of familiarity.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, it's sort of a confluence of things with, you know, their work plus their, you know, how much you see them out at parties, how much they're photographed at award shows, or who they're friends with, you know, can suddenly turn somebody into a much bigger celebrity. You know, there are people you know, one of the things about acting or being a musician or you know, an athlete is that the only way you can be successful is if you're famous. If you're a very, very successful, you can't be a very, very successful actor and only do community theater, or, you know, be a very successful athlete who plays, you know, on weekends. It's like, so the measure of their success also makes them a celebrity. And you kind of can't have it without it.
What about infamy? I mean, I mentioned in the intro mm-hmm. O.J. Simpson, and he's been in the news this week because he's out on parole,
yeah.
I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that people were fascinated with the trial. They're fascinated with how someone who seemed to have it all really
right.
has not, you know, he mm-hmm. got away with murder, and he really has all of this dysfunction. I think we look at him because we want to see what we don't want to become,
mm-hmm.
and I'm sure that's part of it. What do you have to say about infamy?
Well, I think, you know, there have been so many celebrity scandals, and have, you know, from like the beginning of time. And, you know, I think it's like, you know, when little kids see another kid getting in trouble, you know, they're sort of like, oh, I'm good, you know. But they like to watch that. And, you know, the thing with, you know, I think the thing is that at the heart of it, there are people that are just saying they are not better than us, and they're not better than us. They're people. And there are a lot of them that have, you know, very serious mental issues and that play out, now that we, have the internet where they can tweet or Facebook their, breakdowns, there are a lot of issues and certainly addiction issues and various things like that. I mean, the one thing is that, except for, there are some things that you can't come back from. Murder, anybody who has, sexually abused kids. But in terms of, addiction issues, even, if you look at, Robert Downey Jr., he did not appear to be in a place where he could come back from. When he did, he was heralded and people loved it because that is, real-life drama. Here is this guy, he's, had everything, lost everything, then he got everything again. I mean, it's the perfect story.
Right. Well, I don't care who you are, but you must have, all of us have someone that we regard as, we put them at that level of having celebrity status. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would never buy a People magazine. I remember once my sister, who purchases People magazine, said to me, "Oh, isn't it sad about Gwyneth Paltrow's father?" And I said, "Did you know him?" And she, of course, started yelling at me about what a snob I am. And if Terry Gross, for example, walked through this door, do you know who Terry Gross is?
Yeah.
Okay. I would be struck with, I would see her in this huge celebrity light. So we all have someone, right?
Yeah. I have a friend who is an astrophysicist, and he was so excited by this great astrophysicist that he met, and he was, going on about it, as if, the way my aunt talks about the Beatles, it was like, there are people that are celebrities in different realms. I mean, there's celebrity, I mean, it's not really celebrity, famous and renowned and, lauded. And I mean, the people I've been more obsessed with, in the last, certainly since, last fall, are the Obamas. I love to see pictures of the Obamas out and about, and my heart is broken when I see them. But I think they're such stellar people and truly good people, and I definitely they're the ones that I would like to have dinner with now.
Yeah,
and I would kidnap them and. Help them, make them figure out what to do.
Julie, isn't the sort of the wonder of celebrity the fact that O.J. Simpson won't have a problem finding a foursome to play golf?
There are reprehensible people in the world, and I saw somebody talking about that he might be picked for Donald Trump's cabinet for something. I think that there are people that wouldn't go anywhere near him, and there are definitely, he's not going to be getting any endorsement deals. But of course, there'll always be somebody and who will be with anybody because they're famous.
I'll admit, I regret losing a photograph of me and O.J. I think it was the 1975 Pro Bowl when the teams were warming up, and there we were side by side.
those lost things, those lost treasures. I used to write letters to people. I wrote letters to politicians and celebrities, and I had a lot of responses in a box somewhere, and I have no idea. I've moved too many times and lost them, but they are treasures to have.
So we've talked a lot about people who are genuine stars and celebrities, and no questions about it, and none of them would have a word to say to us on the subject. But let's go to the other end and the 15-minute of fame chasers that the internet has wrought, and the YouTube stars and Instagram celebrities.
Yeah, that has changed the definition of celebrity. There are now people, and I haven't heard of most of them, but they are, if you look them up on Twitter or Instagram, they have 4.5 1.5 million people who are following them and interested in them, and that's a lot. The thing that people can be famous for now, it doesn't necessarily have to do with talent. A lot of it has to do with a lack of shame or a willingness to do anything or, you know, expose themselves in, to me, the same way as like the Real Housewives and, you know, those kind of things sort of, you know, I would rather not. I wouldn't do that. But there are clearly many people who would.
Our guest is Julie Clam. The book is The Stars in Our Eyes, The Famous, The Infamous, and Why We Care Way Too Much About Them. And Julie, I have to tell you that the person in your book that you discuss that Graham and I have emailed back and forth about more than any other is the person who does nude yoga with 2.5 million followers. I have to bring it up because Graham can't, right?
Right.
But I've never heard of this person, but
no,
do talk.
No, you wouldn't. But that doesn't affect them. And, you know, they don't need everybody to know who they are. It's unbelievable to me because a lot of times, you know, I find out about like YouTubers for my daughter who's, you know, 14, and, you know, she'll say, oh my God, so-and-so is so hilarious and great. You've got to watch blah, blah, blah. And then when I look and they have, you know, 18 million followers and they make a lot of money doing what they're doing because a lot of eyeballs are on them and they can, you know, sell huge ads and, you know, they're making it work. I don't see it as as something that's going to last them forever, but, you know, maybe if they make the right investments, they'll be okay.
Julie, we live in Park City, Utah. We have our share, an abundance of celebrities in this community, most of whom we ignore.
Yeah.
But we also have an overabundance of dogs who we do not ignore. And I wanted to give you just a moment to give yourself a little pitch on your interest in dogs.
Oh, well, I do dog rescue, and that is my heart. I started rescuing Boston Terriers and then, you know, just started rescuing everyone who needed rescuing. But I live in a New York City apartment. At one point, I had five dogs, and I realized that it had gone too far. I have a very hard time saying no, but I'm really good at fostering dogs and finding them homes, so I have a skill with that, and so I try to get them in and out and not keep them, and that's a big thing. And I wrote about that in You Had Me at Woof and Love at First Bark. I adore them. And at the end of the day, I'd much rather be, you know, sitting on my couch with my dogs than,
just about anyone. Well, and speaking of, as you were speaking about dogs, I had to think about internet sensations and the most famous dog I can think of. There's a border collie that's really talented, but I've got to go with the dog who walks on its hands while urinating. You know which one I'm talking about?
But I will definitely Google that.
Oh, I'm going to have to look for that and send it to you.
I will. Yeah. I know. There's a dog in my neighborhood, a English bulldog that rides a skateboard, and I find that to be pretty impressive. But
that
apparently,
is.
When I mentioned it to somebody else who has an English bulldog, she was like, "Oh yeah, a lot of them do."
That's great.
Well, what's the big deal?
Well, the book, again, is The Stars in Our Eyes, The Famous, The Infamous, and Why We Care Way Too Much About Them. Our guest is Julie Clam, and thank you so much, Julie, for joining us on The Mountain
Life. Thank you so much for having me.
And we will be back after these words from our underwriters. We'll be speaking in the second half about strength-based parenting. Oh, how to find the positive and accentuate, what is the saying? Accentuate the positive and I forget the rest of it, but we'll be back. Stay with us.
Valley Behavioral Health is a local nonprofit and proud supporter of KPCW. We are your community behavioral health center and provide a broad range of services, including individual, family, couples, and group therapy for mental health and substance abuse. We serve all ages in all of Summit County. Please check out our website at valleycares.com or 649-8347 for more information.
Hi, this is Whitney Wall from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. This summer, Park City Mountain offers a variety of events for the whole family, including the annual July 4th celebration and fireworks, summer concert series, and weekly Wednesday Farmers Market. The full calendar of Park City Mountain events is available at parkcitymountain.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host Graham Anthony. We were just speaking with Julie Clam, the stars in our eyes. And now, as parents and humans, we have a tendency to focus on the negative. We ruminate over that single C grade, perhaps, among the A's on our children's report cards. The goal missed instead of the great pass made on the soccer field. The tantrum thrown in the parking lot instead of the toy shared with a sibling. In her game-changing book, The Strength Switch, How the New Science of Strength-Based Parenting Can Help Your Child and Your Teen to Flourish. Our guest, Leah Waters, seeks to change that paradigm, offering a new approach to raising happy and healthy kids that replaces fault-based criticism with positive strength-based reinforcement. She joined me last week from Australia, via Canada, and we're going to air that interview now. Dr. Leah Waters, welcome to The Mountain Life.
It's so great to be with you, Lynn.
So I would just start off by stating the very obvious. Parenting is difficult. And it's especially difficult when we pay attention to the different trends in parenting. And we always wonder if we're doing the right thing. So maybe if we just start with that premise, how do we know if we're doing the right thing, especially when it comes to either praising or disciplining our kids?
Well, it's a great place to start, Lynn, and also just, I think a really insightful observation. It is hard. It's so hard to be a parent. I'm a parent myself. I have a 14-year-old son and a 10-year-old daughter, and I think one of the things that unites any parent is that we absolutely want to do the best for our children, but there's always that element of uncertainty. Like you said, particularly because there's lots of advice out there. And I think one of the things that's different about the strength-based approach, strength-based parenting approach, which is the area that I research in, is that with a strength-based parenting approach, the anchor point for your parenting is your individual child and the strengths that they have. So whenever you're in doubt, lock back into this anchor point, which is your own child and their own strengths. How you apply that to discipline, which is the second part of your question, again, this is something that's sort of unique and new with the strength-based approach, is that rather than kind of always being stuck in that criticism and nagging loop, and I mean, I know it myself as a parent, I feel like I'm often saying no and don't and you can't, is to reframe the situation. So coming into a situation where your kids are misbehaving or there's problem behavior is, rather than thinking sort of what's wrong with my child, is to start first with, okay, what is right with my child and how do I use what's right with them to fix this situation? It's a little bit counterintuitive because none of us are sort of trained to do that, and it probably wasn't the way that we were raised or disciplined ourselves.
Right.
But it's really it's a really constructive way of working with your children around discipline. So to give you a concrete example, if you've got two of your children who are fighting, you know, the natural response is for us to get angry and say, you know, don't fight, I'm sick of this, why are you always fighting? And it's just have that moment of pause as a parent and identify and understand that this is behavior that you don't want and you do want to fix it, but have a moment of pause to think, okay, what is a quality that's already in my child that I can draw on to help them solve the situation? So maybe you have a child who has kindness, or who has another child who's quite fair, or another child who's quite open-minded or has good perspective. So in that discipline situation, rather than going for the don't, I'm sick of this, stop doing this, is just to step back and say, you know, hey, guys, we need a bit of cooperation here. Or, you know, I'm watching this happen. I feel like, where's the kindness that seems to be missing right now? Or this doesn't seem to be a very fair thing to do, and yet I ordinarily see you be so fair in situations. So it's just reframing and calling on a strength that's already sits within your child, so that what you're doing is you're showing them how they can solve the conflict themselves rather than as us parents always having to do it for them.
That's great. And so then the next time a fight is about to ensue, they think about kindness, fairness,
yeah.
and those are the words that rise to the surface then.
Yes.
That makes a lot of great sense. Well, you know, and it's funny, as you're giving that example, it's a great concrete example. And of course, I'm sure all of our listeners right now are thinking of their own example that they have personal struggles with when it comes to their children. Let's talk about when the teenagers, for example, stay up later than the parents. The parents go to bed, the kitchen's clean, they wake up in the morning, and it's a mess. One would try to see the positive spin on that and to identify the child's or the teenager's strengths to somehow reconcile a dirty kitchen. But how do we do that?
That's such a great example, Lynn, and I relate to that myself, actually. So, I mean, the first thing that I would ask you is, what do you see are the positive qualities and the strengths in your children? And then we'll see if we can use some of their own positive qualities to find a solution.
So, you know, you could come up with something like, oh, well, you know, you're really social and you invited your friends over, and that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could say they've learned how to cook,
mm-hmm.
You know, or they've learned how to... be creative in the kitchen. This is a stretch here, Lee, I have to say.
Let's forget about the kitchen for a moment. Just more generally, what do you see as the strengths in your children?
Oh, well, they're inventive and creative and smart, and they like to have fun and
mm-hmm.
all those things.
Okay, so let's go with inventive and social. And so in that case, I would be looking at trying to turn it into a little bit of a game. You know, I see you're so inventive in this area or with this situation. So how can you use your inventiveness to come up with a quick way to clean the kitchen? So it's a win-win for both of us. You still get to eat late at night. You still get to socialize with your friends, but your mum doesn't have to wake up in the morning to clean the kitchen, because it's not good for you when I'm cross about the kitchen anyway.
Yeah.
So have a conversation with them about the way in which they can be more inventive in coming up with a quick, efficient way to clean the kitchen.
I used to do that. I would set the timer and I would say, okay, let's have a race. Because I sort of, for myself, I have to do that. I have to set, you know, so I keep on the kitchen duty. I'll set the timer for 5 minutes and see how much I can get done in five
yeah.
minutes. And I tricked mm-hmm. them with that for a while. That was good.
Yeah. I think anything that you can do where you can turn, particularly when they're younger, if you can turn it into a game,
mm-hmm.
that's always a great way of showing your child what is the behavior that you expect. So it's not that you're ignoring the bad behavior. You're still disciplining your child. I mean, I see the point of discipline is really ultimately it's about teaching your children how to be good people. It's not necessarily about punishing them. They do need to see the consequences of their actions, but the ultimate goal is to teach them how to be better. So turning it into a game is great, and you're probably using your own strengths, Lynn, there, as a parent, to kind of gamify it and make it fun and make it curious. And then gamifying works for some teenagers, not others. It depends on personality. So that's when you would draw on something like their inventiveness or the social part of it, you know, just educating them that a big part of their social skills is to also take care of the people that they live with, not just their friends who are coming over.
Yeah, this is good. So one of the things you said right in the beginning that I love so much is that, you know, one parenting technique might work on one child and backfire on another.
Yeah.
And that's why we need to learn the strengths of our children. And I think about that example of, you know, when you praise a child for doing well, you know, okay, say, for example, you know, your child gets half A's and half C's.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to praise them for the A's, but, you know, sort of remind them about this other part that are the C's.
Yeah, sure.
And you know, one thing you say to one will work and motivate them, where it for another it might discourage them. So how do we find out what our children are like? What are they going to respond best to?
Yeah, great question again. So what we know about the strengths, what the scientists have shown us about the strengths, including my own research, is that if something is a true strength, it has three elements to it. Firstly, it's a quality or a skill or a talent that your child naturally performs well in. Secondly, it's a quality or a skill or a talent that energizes your child. So they just by engaging in the strength, they get energy. And thirdly, it's something that your child is self-motivated to do. So when thinking about this in relation to, you know, one technique might work with one child, a different technique works with another child, is that's because you're coming from your focus point as a parent to say, this is the technique I'm going to apply, rather than starting first with your child and saying, okay, well, what are the strengths? Because when we draw on our children's strengths, they're going to perform well, they're going to have energy, and they're going to be self-motivated. And so that's where we get into that kind of motivational piece and understanding that for one child, praise works in a particular way, and for another child, it works in a different way. It's really getting to that core of what motivates each child, and starting to spot their strengths gives you a sense of what motivates them. So take the example of two children who are learning the piano and having piano lessons, and you'll see, and maybe they're both very good technically, so they have the kind of same level of performance, but you see the one child where the parent has to remind them to practice, mm-hmm. and, you know, sometimes they're happy to do it, other times they're reluctant. You see the other child who you never have to remind and who almost can't walk past the piano without yearning to sit down and start playing.
Mm-hmm.
So they're the kind of three clues that you would look for to get a better sense of what's motivating your child. And then once you start with them as the anchor point, that will give you very good knowledge and information for how it is that you motivate each of your children slightly differently.
Mm, that's good. What about recognizing motivation for the right reasons, motivation for the wrong reasons?
Mm. Can you give me a more concrete example of that, Lynn?
Well, I guess I'm just thinking about sometimes when we push our kids towards academic success, you know, sometimes they're motivated by competition among their peers, or sometimes they're motivated just, you know, to please their parents, or sometimes they're motivated because they just love to do well and they love to learn. And I suppose, I mean, maybe it doesn't help to know, to be able to suss out the difference.
No, I see what you mean now. There's a couple of ways of answering that. I mean, one, there are a number of different surveys out there that you can use to test or get a sense of your strengths. And in fact, on my website, I've got a whole, what I'm calling the library of strengths. So it's over 100 strengths, a list of over 100 strengths with definitions that parents can go and have a look at to start to get a flavor and a sense of all the different strengths that their children and teenagers have. And that list is based on these surveys. In one of the surveys, they actually have competition as a motivator. So for some kids, that competition piece is not necessarily what we would call an external or outside motivator. Mm-hmm. It does come from within. For other kids, that would come more from outside, from external pressure. So the broad distinction that you're getting at is it does have to be self-motivated. It's less healthy and effective if the motivation is coming from outside of the child themselves, if it's coming from parents or school. Not necessarily if it's competition, because for some kids that is an internal motivation, but I think that's where you would then also hit onto the energy piece, mm-hmm. and that would give you a sense of whether is your child doing this and you can see that they feel energized and uplifted by it,
right.
or are they doing it and that, you know, they're kind of doing it for the wrong reasons, then you will see it being depleted at the end of that.
Ah, yeah. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Lee Waters. She's written a new book called The Strength Switch, How the New Science of Strength-Based Parenting Can Help Your Child and Your Teen to Flourish. And if you could talk, Lee, about the three decades of research that is compiled in this book, The Strength Switch, and sort of, you know, your experience and your background.
Sure. So let's start with my background. I am a psychologist. I'm also a research professor at a university in Australia, and I've been doing that for more than two decades. As I mentioned before, importantly, I'm also a mother. So I research in the field of positive psychology, and that's a field that's almost two decades old, but even before the field of positive psychology came along. Now, the emphasis of positive psychology is to study what's right with human nature and how do we amplify that. You know, and that's in contrast to more traditional psychology, which studies what's wrong with us and how do we fix it. So even before that field came along, for a decade before that, there's an allied field called strength-based science. And this field incorporates social work, it incorporates organizations, it incorporates individuals and families. And really the philosophy behind that science is to intentionally and systematically understand who we are at our best. What does a best practice organization look like? How do we create vibrant communities from a social work perspective? How do we create flourishing families? And how do we identify individually ourselves? What are our best features? What are our strengths, skills, and qualities, and amplify those? And what the research has shown, including my own research, I've done a lot of research in schools and also in families, is that when we learn how to identify and build our strengths, this is when we really get the opportunity to thrive and reach our full potential. Three decades of research showing that, for example, in my own research with strength-based parenting, when teenagers and children have strength-based parents, they report higher levels of life satisfaction, higher levels of self-esteem, higher levels of optimism, higher levels of resilience, lower levels of anxiety and depression. Last year, I did an interesting study looking at whether having a strength-based parent was related to academic grades. And it turns out it is. There was a significant relationship between teenagers who said, my parents see my strengths and help me to use my strengths, and then the academic grades that they were receiving.
There's so much talk now about grit and resilience, and it seems like every time we talk about it, it is because we have diminished our ability in that regard, I suppose. And I think when it comes to being resilient as a child, and especially an adolescent, and then moving away from the home, this is the complaint I hear. Some professionals that work in an academic setting, that kids come in and they're not resilient. Like, their parents have done everything for them and they don't know how to deal on their own.
Mm-hmm.
Are we seeing more issues with resilience that you've experienced?
That certainly seems to be a trend. And the thing about that is that when we see, well, it's a chicken and an egg thing, isn't it? Because we don't know if the resilience is low and therefore parents step in and become helicopter parents and lawnmower parents and overprotect,
mm-hmm.
or to what degree are parents creating low resilience because they are overprotecting, they are being helicopter parents, they are being a lawnmower parents. By the way, do you use that expression, lawnmower parents, in the States, or is that just an Australian expression?
I was just sitting here thinking. I don't believe we use it. We do use helicopter parents. What's a lawnmower parent?
Yeah, okay. So the helicopter parent is the idea of the parent sort of always hovering above and quickly rescuing their child, creating that sort of snowflake child. The lawnmower parent, at least in Australia, the way we use that expression is it's the parent who kind of is out the front of the child, mowing down the path that they want the child to walk on, making sure that there's, you know, nothing that can harm the child in the pathway.
Yeah.
So it's a similar sort of concept.
Uh-huh.
But what I was saying is that, you know, I'm a parent myself, we're raising children in just a vastly different era to the way in which at least I was raised. And it's nerve-wracking being a parent dealing with a world that has terrorism and trauma and turmoil and trying to deal with technology and screen time and cyberbullying. And I think that it's a natural response for parents to want to protect their child. But the unintended or potentially negative outcome of that is this overprotective parent, which then leads to the trends we're seeing in low grit and low resilience. But what I've found in my work with parents teaching them and training them how to take on a strength-based approach is it is a bit of an antidote to that overprotective parent, because rather than protecting your child from the outside by hovering over the top of them or mowing out a path in front of them, strength-based parenting helps to teach your children how they can protect themselves from the inside.
Mm.
And that's because what you're doing as a strength-based parent is you're helping your child to see and build upon their strengths, those positive qualities, the things that they do well at, have energy, from and are self-motivated to do. And what that means then is that the child learns that it doesn't matter where they are, in any situation, they have this kind of internal mental health toolkit, if you like. They know that they can draw on their communication skills or their problem-solving skills or their great social skills, whatever their particular strengths happen to be. So wherever they go and whenever they're in new situations, they've got this internal toolkit that is their strength that helps them to navigate challenge, which means they don't have to rely on the overprotective parent.
Right. You know, my perspective is different as a parent than someone who has young children at this moment in time. But something that I think can apply to all ages, and maybe you can give us some more concrete examples of how we give them that toolkit at a young age. This would go for everyone, the whole concept of, you know, doing your homework, getting your schoolwork done. And then as you're in high school, it's all about the studying for the entrance exams, in our case, it's the ACT and the SATs. Mm-hmm. You know, and so often I hear parents say, especially, you know, later on in high school, they say, if I didn't walk them through every step of this, they wouldn't end up going to college at all.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say for, you know, creating that toolkit?
That's a beautiful question too. And yes, we do have similar systems and similar pressures in Australia. So the first thing I would say is for the parents, I'm going to take a step back even further. The first thing I would say is it's never too early and it's also never too late to become a strength-based parent. So from that then, even when you have very young children, the first step is for you as a parent to start to understand what strengths are and how you spot them in your children. Now, the psychologists kind of broadly classify strengths into three broad categories, and they are strengths of the head, strengths of the heart, and strengths of will. And what we also know is that even though each of your children will have their own particularly unique skills and talents, when it comes to sort of character, every child has certain strengths of the head, certain strengths of the heart, and certain strengths of the will. And the evolutionary psychologists sort of endorse this idea that everyone has good character. So in the early years, it's really about recognizing as a parent that your children have strengths of head, strengths of heart, and strengths of will, and giving your child praise, giving them relationships, giving them situations where you can see those three different categories of strengths coming forward. And as you start to work with those three categories of strengths, then that's when you would, as you're going through this very long educational journey, and essentially you're being a partner to your child through that journey, is to teach them when do they need to use their strengths of head. So that's their problem-solving skills, analytical skills, kind of intellect. When do they need to use their strength of heart? So recognizing that how can they, it's a long journey, the social element of school is important, how do they use that to help them learn and do effectively? And when do they use these strengths of will? So that's things like persistence and grit and kind of staying at a task. Mm-hmm. So it would be about educating your children that they have these three clusters of strengths inside of them and then showing them how it is they use them through the educational journey.
Wow, that's great stuff. I'm so glad we got a chance to speak today. The book is called The Strength Switch, How the New Science of Strength-Based Parenting Can Help Your Child and Your Teen to Flourish. My guest is Dr. Lee Waters. And Lee, thank you so much for joining me.
It's been a pleasure. I really appreciate you having me on the show, Lynn.
All right. Take care. Enjoy your vacation.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye. And we want to thank our underwriters, Berkshire Hathaway, Home Services Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Davidson Orthopedics, Park City Mountain, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Zions Bank, Valley Behavioral Health, and Fairway Independent Mortgage. And you've been listening to KPCW Park City. It's time now for national news from Washington.